You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is a true story.
It was 2013. RX had been on hiatus for a couple years. The only thing that we did was a short run of four or five shows in Brazil the previous summer. A couple years prior, we had decided as a band to step away and take some time to reassess things, sort of, at the time, an indefinite hiatus. We had reached this point where the success that we always wanted was coming to us, but it didn't look or feel like we expected. Thanks to the energy and power of Kathy Pello and Sargent House, which had been formed around us, we were starting to make a really decent living playing in a band. Unfortunately, since the only thing we had ever thought about or put energy into was touring and being the best musicians we could be, we didn't really pay attention to the fact that we were ill-equipped emotionally and psychologically to deal with the new set of issues that would come along with our new level of success. However modest that new level of success may have been, it still introduced us to the fact that our communication amongst ourselves, our self-realization and understanding of each other was far below what we needed to continue going as separate individuals who wanted to come together to achieve a common goal. So, after a couple years of doing our own thing, feeling that void left by the absence of RX, which had totally consumed all of our lives for 10, 11 years, which at that age is certainly a lifetime, at least half to one third of our lives at that point. After that couple years, we were ready to get back at it. And the first offer for our first US show was for the newly revived Skate and Surf Festival. As a Californian, I always thought that name was funny because I never saw skating or surfing at any of the festivals, but maybe it was just supposed to be like a catchy name. It was definitely memorable. So anyway, after a few years, Skate and Surf turned into this thing called Bamboozle, which we also played. And this was the first year in 2013 that they were going to bring back Skate and Surf. Rather than being in the streets of Asbury Park, this year was going to be at Six Flags. So with it being a short 2.5 day trip, getting to see lots of friends, getting paid well, and getting to ride roller coasters, it was an easy decision to make. So now we cut to Friday, May 17th, the day we are flying out to New Jersey for our Saturday performance at Skate and Surf Festival. This flight is LAX to Newark, which, as far as commuter flights across the country goes, has to be one of the busiest, aside from LAX to JFK or LAX to O'Hare. And so with our flight being on a Friday, leaving from LAX on either United or American, one of the American-based airlines, out of the domestic terminal, we got to the airport a bit earlier than usual with some time to kill, just because when you're coming from Long Beach, traffic going north on the 405, especially towards Century Boulevard or the 105, which you're going to take to LAX, it can take a really long time. So we're there early. We're there with some time to kill due to the fact that it's a greedy, cattle-herding, American-based airline. We are at one of the gates that is split into A and B. So it's gate 26, but there's a gate 26A, and there's a gate 26B. The waiting area is still completely loaded up with people waiting for flights departing, you know, while we're there before our flight has even arrived to get cleaned and then to ultimately board. So next to that gate was a seafood restaurant of like the generic chain sort. It's called Gladstone's, I believe, you know, just an overpriced waspy type of place, you know. But it was the only thing there next to like a Starbucks or, you know, those little magazine kiosks with trail mix and chips and bullshit like that. So Roger and I and Matt, we go sit down at this Gladstone's. So everybody has this thing that I like to call exostasis, which is our human balance of exogenous substances that we kind of choose to intake to regulate and or control our state of mind at any given time for different contexts. So whether it's your nightly glass of wine, your weekend 50 beers, or you know, daily hard cardio, or whatever it is, Call of Duty at night, like everybody's got their thing, right? And this is especially true when traveling, especially traveling through airports where the human experience and the human condition is so highly concentrated into this format that works for maximum profit for the airlines and airports, while still prioritizing safety, but safety only for profits. It creates this environment that, especially for people like me with anxiety problems, but also in particular social anxiety problems, I mean, it's a hotbed for some real uncomfortable feelings and experiences. So that said, you know, you'll usually see airport bars pretty happening. Having beers or drinks seems to be the most common popular form of everybody making sure that they feel okay, you know, before they get on whatever it is, 5, 10, 13 hour flight. But for me, it's always been cannabis, particularly edibles before any flight, 4 or 5 hours and up, just because they last longer. You don't have to smoke or fumble with gear or fly with anything that might get you in trouble. Alcohol and I had parted ways a while before that, and I only really drank regularly for a pretty short period of time. So while Matt and Roger were enjoying their beers, I decided to have some of my Bang Bar, which is a brand that I liked at the time because they made dairy-free chocolates, and they had this chocolate mint flavor that was potent and tasted good and wasn't filled with a bunch of crap. So we're sitting at Gladstone's, probably still have another 40, 45 minutes before we board, and I eat half of my Bang Bar. Other guys are moving on to their second or third beers. And yeah, we're chilling. Everything's cool. See, with edibles, everything is cool until it's not. Oftentimes, it's great. You're familiar with how much it takes for you to feel a certain way. And you know, you've experienced it. You stick to products that you know. But anybody who's, you know, eaten edibles knows that there's always an element of this variable where your body chemistry, the amount of food you have in your stomach, your level of stress, lack of sleep, whatever else, all these sort of, I don't know, physiological factors definitely influence how your body is going to react to that edible on that given day. See, the reason edibles are so potent is because when you eat it as opposed to smoking it, your stomach processes it, and then it goes to your liver, where it creates all these different other psychoactive compounds and metabolites, one of those being called 11-hydroxy-THC, which is commonly known to produce psychoactive effects on average 4 to 5 times stronger than the normal THC that we ingest when smoking. Now, for those of you who have been using cannabis and edibles, I don't need to explain this part to you, but for those of you who are non-cannabis users and have never really had edibles, if you overdose yourself, it can essentially feel like the strongest psychoactive experience you've ever had, and that's put up against psilocybin, LSD, or whatever else that you can think of that we've probably tried. Sorry, mom and dad. Sorry to all my family. I'm a grown-ass 41-year-old man, but I'm still worried about everybody hearing this. Oh well, let's move on. So, here we are now back at Gladstone's LAX in the domestic terminal on a Friday late afternoon. There's a basket of fried calamari or something sitting in between us. And I've just eaten an amount of cannabis chocolate that I'm used to. It's an amount that I've eaten before rehearsal that has kept me at a level feeling good, wasn't overwhelmed or anything like that. But today, I don't know why. Maybe it was a consistency issue in the product itself. Within 25 minutes, which is a little bit sooner than it usually starts taking effect, I am nearing the edge. And the edge is a particular feeling, I think, that's unique to a cannabis edible-induced psychoactive experience, where it feels like you're essentially basically just at this point where your psyche and consciousness and what you physically feel because of that cannot get any more intense. So you wonder if right beyond that boundary is just darkness and or cardiac arrest and or, you know, the dissolving of all reality as you know it. Sounds fun, right? Really isn't. But to be honest, being in densely crowded places or sitting in traffic feels just as horrible to me. So, yeah. Anyway, so I'm sitting here way too high, not feeling comfortable, not having my anxiety or stress mitigated, but rather amplified at this point. I would like to add that while some of you may interpret this as a cautionary tale or a reason to stay away from cannabis or edible use, I don't mean it that way. I view this no differently than viewing overeating and feeling sick or having too many drinks and ruining the whole next day or working out so hard that you give yourself an injury. I'm not saying that they're all the same thing. I'm saying that all of those things, including this, lead us to understanding our bodies and our limits better, and also understanding the context and circumstances that create variability in how our bodies react to things. There's a really important lesson and really valuable insight into being one with ourselves that I think comes from these experiences. If you don't traumatize the shit out of yourself and just, you know, not recover from it. So here I am sitting in this seat at seafood restaurant I don't want to be at, inside of an airport I don't want to be at, about to get on a plane I don't want to be in to go to Newark, New Jersey, which I definitely don't want to be in, to eventually get to a show which I really do want to play. And the walls are closing in. I mean, like anxiety, lyrical cliche closing in. Like, this is a large restaurant. There are no walls even near me, and they're closing in. I'm breathing deep, trying to keep my cool. Unfortunately, this is long before I had started my mindfulness meditation practice, so it wasn't something that I had to utilize then. So naturally, another key feature of psychoactive experiences kicks in, which is a total loss of perception of time. I'm thinking we still have time, but I haven't realized that it's only Roger and I left in the restaurant now, Everyone else has gotten up to go board, go to the bathroom before or whatever. So as we're sitting there in the restaurant, we look at the time and it was about time to board. We weren't close enough, or we were separated by enough things where we couldn't hear the announcement from the gate itself. So Roger and I pay our bill. We kind of scurry over to the gate, which was adjacent to the restaurant, you know, not too far, but not immediately right there. And it's busy. We go to our line, waiting for 5 minutes because our boarding group had already been called. And, you know, naturally we weren't part of one of the first boarding groups. So we didn't have to wait too long. We get our boarding passes scanned. We do the typical thing. You're kind of slowly moving along in this amusement park style line. I'm now inside the tunnel portion of the gate before you reach the actual plane itself. And I am not feeling chill. It's extra claustrophobic in there. There's no ventilation. It's not really a hot day, but it's not a cold enough day to make that zone not stuffy. So yeah, I'm still pretty uncomfortable. I'm still tripping. I'm still very close to the edge. We finally reach the door of the plane, turn that corner right into first class, which on domestic flights is the class of, look, I boarded before you. Now I get to watch you walking past me and you get to look at me sitting in my seat that I got to sit in way before you and pay a lot more for. And I'm feeling a little relief. I spot our seats towards the back of the plane, but I still see that the aisle is completely filled with people at a dead stop due to the typical thing of everybody putting their luggage in the overhead bins and getting situated and stuff. It's just normal plane boarding stuff. Roger is directly behind me. I'm still high out of my mind, staring at all these people in their seats. Feeling like they're all staring back at me, which they probably weren't. And just trying to talk myself through this, keep everything mellow. I was just saying to myself, as soon as you get to your seat, put on your headphones, put on some sea and cake, and you're good. You'll wake up in Newark. So, obviously, I have no idea how much time has passed. Probably was like 3 or 4 minutes, felt like 20, but we are finally passing the halfway point of the plane towards the back half, reaching our aisle. I look back and the aisle is still filled. There's people behind us all the way back towards the front of the plane waiting to get in, waiting to get to their seats. We were probably only 3 or 4 steps away from our aisle when we hear the flight attendant get on the intercom and make the announcement for the flight. To our dismay, the flight attendant says, "Welcome to blah, blah, blah Airlines, flight number 266 with service to Spokane, Washington." My stomach dropped. And I had this feeling like my vision was narrowing again and this sort of burning in my frontal lobe like I had just been punched in the face. Like, we were supposed to be flying to Newark. How did this happen? So I look back at Roger and he's looking straight at me with the outside of his eyebrows kind of dropping. You know, that creating that expression of like, oh shit, we are so fucked. What can we even do? I'm still so out of my mind that I don't even have the faculties to be frustrated about the fact that someone scanned our boarding passes and didn't even bother to look. They didn't even pay attention to the fact that we weren't supposed to be on that flight. We were supposed to be going somewhere else in a very different direction. I look around trying to get my wits about me. I look back at Roger, we lock eyes, we don't even say anything. He just turns around, I'm already facing in that direction, and we just start trying to push our way through this line of people in a very narrow aisle with most of the length of the plane to still travel. Obviously, we look like terribly rude dickheads. People are really bummed. We're literally having to push through them, you know, as much as we can without actually committing assault. A lot of them are stepping into aisles, you know, essentially having to like stick their butts in the faces of people sitting down already. And we're in panic mode. We're not thinking about anything. So we're not even perceiving, you know, the dirty looks, the gasps, the people saying, hey, what the hell? What's your problem? But we're making progress. We've reached the first class section of the plane at the front of the plane, you know? And Roger's a little bit ahead of me. He broke through a little bit better. I see him nearing the front of first class, turning, exiting the plane. And I'm at the threshold, that border between coach and first class. And I'm thinking, okay, we're going to make this. I see the door. I see the confused look on the flight attendants' faces. I look back and I see all the frustrated, irritated people at us. But it's okay because we're going to make it. I'm about to step into first class and I feel a hand grab my arm. It wasn't a get my attention grab. It was a firm, authoritarian grab. And I hear a voice say, hey, where are you off to so fast? Why are you in such a hurry? And I look back, and there's this older, probably between 50 and 60, older white man wearing a Seattle Mariners baseball cap, glasses, tattered t-shirt, and he's still holding my arm. I look at him, and you know, normally I like to think of myself as articulate to a certain degree, at least enough to, you know, make my point and respond to situations and defend myself if need be. But I could not have been further from that mindset, and I could not have been more psychologically compromised than I was at that very moment. Not only by the circumstances that I had created for myself, but just because also that element of ambush and surprise, which was now being forced upon me. I finally, you know, moving past my shock and awe, am able to spit out the words, we're on the wrong flight. We didn't realize it. I need to go. To which he responds, I don't think so. You guys were looking sketchy when you got on the plane, and then all of a sudden, both of you are rushing off, carrying those bags. How do I know that you didn't plant a bomb or something? How do I know that you don't have bombs in that bag? Now, let's take a second. Yes, this actually really happened, and he literally said those words verbatim. I know this country has a problem with racism. And I'm not saying that this particular situation was caused by racism, because I don't really know for sure. But what I do know was that there was a lot of North Korea and nuclear threat going around in the media at that time, as it kind of has been regularly for a long time now. And, you know, I think a lot of times people view the Pacific Northwest, like Washington and Oregon, as being these like largely liberal places because they look at cities like Portland and Seattle. But I think that's a misconception, you know. I think that what people don't realize is that a huge majority of these states are filled with rural folk, country folk, who don't have a lot of cultural and or social exposure. And if this guy was one of those people and maybe hadn't flown a lot, you know, I can actually understand how seeing what he saw was a little bit concerning. But I mean, I don't got time for paranoid racist yokels, you know? I had a show to make. I had a life to live. So, here I am back, now standing at the front of first class because we made our way over there after I told him to let me go and to quit touching me. Everybody is silent on the plane staring at us. And first class, which is our audience now, we're literally standing at the front of first class where the flight attendants would normally give their demonstration about, you know, seatbelts and all that other crap. And some of the people are looking down really uncomfortably, trying to be like, what should I do? Should I speak up or not? I could totally see the look on their faces like, dude, this guy is obviously not some North Korean terrorist. You know, what is this guy's deal? And then there were some, I could see the looks in their eyes going like, yeah, what if he's right? Like, what the hell? And then, you know, the flight attendants, there was like three of them at that point were split. Like two of them were like, what? And then one of them's like, looks at the guy and says, would you like me to go get an air marshal? Of course she was white. The other two flight attendants were not. And he goes, yes, I would. So she goes, okay. I'm sitting there at the front of the plane just thinking like, Roger just got out of here. He has no idea what's happening to me. I'm stuck on this plane with this guy holding me under some dumbass citizen's arrest because he thought I planted a bomb on the plane because somebody who failed at their job at the gate let me onto this flight that I shouldn't have been on to begin with. Not only that, I still have half of this cannabis chocolate bar in my backpack. And if they find that, I'm definitely not making the show. So at this point, my bad trip turned into an even worse trip. I'm still trying to find the thoughts that would form sentences that could put together an idea that I could communicate that might get through to these people. But all I'm able to muster is I'm a musician. I'm in a band. We're going to New Jersey to play a festival tomorrow. I'm not a terrorist. I think I repeated that twice. And I distinctly remember this guy looking at me and giving me that look of like, you are a guitarist in a rock band. And you're going to play some big festival like you're some rock star. Yeah, right, dude. I'm utterly screwed. I didn't know what to do. People were moving. I was hearing sounds, but time had frozen. And I was now in this experience. Like you would be in a medieval Iron Maiden torture device. I mean, I'm in it. I don't know how much more time passes, but I start to hear some whispers and some mumbles here in first class, not too far from me. And then I hear this voice that says, I don't know, I think this is bullshit, man. Are you sure? And so the guy who detained me looks back and is like, yeah, I don't know this guy. I mean, one second he's here and the next he's rushing off the plane. I mean, how do I know he didn't plant a bomb? I look over at the two other flight attendants who were both people of color. And they were talking amongst each other, looking at me. And one of them comes over to me. He was this Latino guy. And he says, this is such bullshit. I'm sorry this is happening to you. And I go, thank you. I mean, it's okay. I'm not a terrorist. I need to make my flight. I cannot miss it. And he looks at me and says, you know, I believe you. And I go, can you please help me? Please help me if you believe me. And I see him look back at the entrance of the plane, look up the gate, and he looks at the other flight attendant who's like looking at us. And they kind of nod at each other. And he turns around and he says to me, "Do you want to just go?" And I'm like, "Really? Can I?" Because at that point, the guy who had detained me had already returned to his seat, you know, four or five aisles back, right behind first class at the beginning of coach. And he goes, "Yeah, just go." I take a look back, I look forward, and I literally sprint out the door of the plane. I sprint up the ramp, back towards the gate at the terminal, and I see that other flight attendant on the phone. As I'm passing her, I look at my boarding pass and I go, "Where do I need to go? I need to find this flight." And I see that it says 26A, gate 26A, not B. And just as I pass that counter, I look to my right, and just 20 feet away is the entrance and the boarding pass scanner for gate 26A. 26A, not 26B. This plane is much larger. You know, your typical 747, four seats in the middle, three seats on each side, two aisles going up parallel. And I see Matt, Joe, Seagak, Roger, all sitting in their seats, listening to music or watching whatever on their phones. And my seat is behind all of them. So I walk past all of them, put my bag in the overhead bin, take my seat. And as soon as the bin door and my seatbelt was fastened, the plane was moving. We were taxiing, going to the runway for takeoff. Since it's very unlike me to be the last to board a flight, let alone hold the flight up because I'm so late, obviously Roger thought maybe I had like an emergency bathroom break or something like that. He turns around and he looks at me with this concerned look and he mouths the words, "What happened?" I had this impulse to tell him and everybody on the plane exactly what had happened. It was almost too much of an experience to like keep inside of me because I had experienced so many extreme things at once. I had experienced, you know, pushing myself to the edge, too much edibles. I had experienced somebody who had too much authority to exercise, being too paranoid about certain people and flying. I had experienced, you know, complacency and an accepted form of racial discrimination. I had experienced, thank God, the recognition and support of some other people that saw the different side of that situation, you know, from my perspective. I had faced almost going to jail, missing the flight, not making the show, you know, just a whole headache. And somehow I was still sitting on that flight. I wanted to talk about all that. I wanted to tell him. I just looked at him and I mouthed the words, "You wouldn't believe me if I told you." I put on my headphones. We took off. We were in the air. We eventually made it to our hotel. The next morning, we woke up to a text from our booking agent, Dave Shapiro. And the text read, "If you guys don't want to play today, it's your choice and I will still get you your money." And two things come to mind when you read a text like that. First is, what the hell is going on? And then the second thought is, it's great to have one of the best, most badass booking agents in the game. Turns out that for whatever reason, whether it be logistical failings, and or fuckery on a governmental level, which was the reason pitched to us. It was said to us that because of the previous hurricanes, the governor would not allow those covers on the stage, those big metal roof or ceiling type things on those mobile stages, to be used for this festival. And it was raining. So either someone or a group of people decided that they still wanted to have the festival go on for the sake of profits and for all of these musicians to stand on a really, really electrified stage with even more electrical equipment, totally uncovered, getting wet in the rain. It all worked out though. We played, got to hang with friends. If you were there or you've seen pictures or videos, you would see that I was the only one in our band that got to have a little pop-up tent put over me just because of all my synths and pedals and stuff, but the other guys just had to get wet. They made illustrations for some of the bands playing, for the laminate and for certain promotional pieces, and the illustration of RX is pretty funny. I don't think they knew how to draw my skin tone, so I came out like this sort of olive green, and with the way they drew my hair, I kind of come out looking like a radioactive, seasick, Asian Frankenstein emo kid. It's pretty funny. After our set, we went over to the roller coasters, and we used our laminates from the festival to lie to the kids working the lines, tell them that the festival said that our laminates work as fast passes. So we skipped all the lines and got to ride a bunch of roller coasters, and then we flew back home to California the next morning. Thanks for listening. Oh, and always triple check your boarding passes.
Hey, you. Did you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020'd? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020'd, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020'd.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-d.com, soundtalentmedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.